This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Mackenzie Schirilla is sitting in an Ohio reformatory right now for women. She's 21. She, if you are just catching up on the chaos of this case, convicted of killing two people, her boyfriend Dominic Russo and their friend Davion Flanagan, after she drove a Toyota Camry into a brick wall at roughly 100 miles an hour in Strongsville, Ohio. A judge found it deliberate, premeditated. She's serving 15 years to life, and on a recorded phone call from prison, her biggest concern is getting her iPad. You can hear the call. It was obtained by reporters and published. Mackenzie is talking to her mother, Natalie. And she's asking her to call the facility to push for the iPad. Can you call and ask? Please, please, please. Her mother tells her she can't. The last time she called about something, the prison staff told her it would be considered special treatment. And Mackenzie's response on a recorded line in a state correctional facility where she's serving time for two murders is, "What the F, man?" Not grief, not reflection, not even basic awareness that she's being recorded. Just irritation that the world isn't delivering what she wants on her schedule. That moment, that tiny, petty, completely unself-aware moment is the whole story of how Mackenzie Schirilla got here. Not the crash, not the 100 miles an hour, the fact that nobody in her entire life at any point ever let her feel the consequence she couldn't complain her way out of. That's what this episode is about. Not whether she did it. A court answered that. This is about the 17 years before the crash that built the person capable of it. And the two people who were supposed to be the guardrails. As we go through this, your thoughts in that comment section there on Substack and YouTube. And be sure to press subscribe wherever you're listening or watching us. July 31st of 2022, Strongsville, Ohio. 5:30 in the morning, Mackenzie, 17 at the time, is driving home from a friend's house with Dominic, 20, and Davion, who's 19. The car, a 2018 Toyota Camry, makes a controlled turn into Elmita Drive, then accelerates nearly half a mile at close to 100 miles an hour. No braking. The car slams into a brick wall of a commercial building. Dominic and Davion are pronounced dead at the scene. Mackenzie is extracted from the wreckage and airlifted to a hospital. Black box data showed the accelerator was pressed to full capacity for an extended period. Forensic examination found no mechanical failure. Brakes, steering, tires, all functioning. The judge who heard the case called her hell on wheels and found that she'd crashed the car intentionally. In August of 23, she was convicted of 12 felony counts, including four counts of murder. She was sentenced to two concurrent terms at 15 years to life. That's the case, okay? We're not going to relitigate the case here. It's established. It's been upheld on appeal. The Ohio Supreme Court declined to even hear it. What hasn't been established, what nobody really has sat with, is the question underneath. How does a 17-year-old get to the point where this is even in the range of possible decisions? And the answer is not just she's a monster. You know, I get it. But monsters don't build themselves. After the Netflix documentary The Crash put this case back in the national spotlight, a series of prison phone calls between Mackenzie and her parents were obtained by multiple outlets. And if you want to understand how Mackenzie Schirilla was built, those calls are the blueprint. In one call, Mackenzie and her mother are discussing prison life, the programs available, the educational opportunities, and mental health resources. Mackenzie says she appreciates that they try to make it somewhat manageable in there. And then Natalie mentions that prison is supposed to be rehabilitative. And Mackenzie says on a recorded line, "But I don't need to be rehabilitated. Like, I don't need that." Set that down for a second. A woman convicted of two murders, a conviction upheld, saying she doesn't need rehabilitation. That's not really defiance. That's not bravado. That's a person who genuinely does not believe the thing that happened is the thing that happened. And here's the part that matters. Her mother does not push back. Natalie doesn't say, you know, Kenzie, you were convicted. We have to deal with this reality.
No. Why would she do that? Why would she try to hold her daughter accountable now that she's finally locked in a cage? Because the world has held her accountable because they failed her so badly. She tells her daughter rehabilitation is for actual criminals. Not you, she says. People who have been convicted of actual crimes.
Their daughter was convicted of actual murder by an actual judge on actual evidence. And on an actual recorded prison phone call, Natalie Shirilla is telling her that doesn't count. In another call, Natalie refers to the family of Dominic Russo, the young man her daughter was convicted of killing, as evil people. Not because they did something evil, because they're grieving. Because they blame Mackenzie. And in Natalie's framework, blaming Mackenzie for the thing Mackenzie was convicted of doing is an unforgivable act and makes you evil. And then there's Steve. Steve Mackenzie. Dad. Pothead extraordinaire. And look, I'm not dissing it. I'm a user myself. But why that was even brought up into the documentary as some sort of a selling point for your behavior or the choices that you're making or allowing your daughter to make, or like it truly reeks. Reeks of very low level problem solving skills, critical thinking, parenting skills. Steve, you really probably shouldn't be a dad, in my opinion. But you are. And you have been, and you did what you did, and you raised a daughter this way. I don't think you've done anything necessarily. Well, you actually probably have done some criminal things by allowing your daughter to do what she's done. But I don't know. Maybe I'm. That would be for a court to decide. Allowing your daughter access to those. I don't know what the laws are there. I'm assuming there might be some possible repercussions for being the cool dad and being down with her getting all doped up and whatever else was going on that you knew about and didn't intervene on as a responsible parent. There might be some laws broken there. Could be. I don't know. Not an attorney. I'm just saying might be. Nothing that I think like you need to go away for or anything needs to be litigated, but I'm just saying. Steve. You may be the cool dad, but where'd that get you? Your daughter's life is destroyed, and you're still being cool on Netflix. He's an art and digital media teacher, or was, at a Catholic school in Cleveland until they said, we're not going to renew your contract. And he said, I wasn't going to come back anyhow. I know you are, but what am I? Steve appeared in the Netflix documentary and said on camera that he had no problem with Mackenzie using marijuana. His words, I don't have a problem with her smoking dope. If you're going to take a drug, that's the one I believe you should take. It's better than alcohol. It's better than all the other crap. Not for a developing brain. Really, none of it's good for a developing brain at all. But I'm glad you're cool with it. I'm glad your run-on rant there really was more about justifying your own poor decision-making in your series of short self-confirmary sentences. I'm glad you've calmed that anxiety down within yourself and you've told yourself enough times that you were just doing the right thing, that you're good with it. How'd that work out for you and your daughter? He said it on a Netflix documentary about his daughter's murder conviction. In his capacity as a teacher at a Catholic school, And when the school placed him on administrative leave and ultimately did not renew his contract, Steve's response wasn't reflection. It wasn't, maybe I shouldn't have said that on camera. Maybe that was, it was that the school and the diocese showed their true colors. Yeah, in a remarkable moment of common sense and accountability for the people of which they employ. The fucking Catholic Church, the Catholic school, the diocese made a competent decision. That in itself is to be applauded and a rare thing in the world. I mean, for a group that's great at covering things up. Wow. Steve talking about dope was a bridge too far. Like, I agree. But at the same point, it's like, where is your bar over there, Catholic diocese, of like what's acceptable and what's not? The attention gets too strong, then we got to cut rope. But if nobody's really looking very closely, then everything is going to be okay. We'll just move this little pastor or this priest from here to this church, to that church, and never tell anyone about his love of children. What is the bar? He talks about dope on camera. He's gone. But, you know, I don't know. Maybe you're fixing up things over there. I can have the two feelings at the same time, hypocrisy and justification. They both land in the same arena with me because we look at things honestly here. When Mackenzie faces consequences, the problem is the people who impose them. When Natalie faces the reality of what her daughter did, the problem is the family that's grieving. When Steve faces professional consequences for his own words, the problem is the institution that employed him. It's the same operating system running on three different machines, really, and it's been running on Mackenzie's her entire life. It's the preloaded software, if you will. And here's where this stops being just a Mackenzie Shirilla story and starts being a story about every parent who's listening that recognizes something. Because I think that's really the crux of this story. And why so many people have been watching The Crash on Netflix and identifying with it and feeling something visceral, and why we've been talking about this 1 hour and 30 minute documentary so damn much. It's because every person in this audience knows a version of this kid. And probably these parents. Not a killer. That's the extreme. But the kid whose parents always had an explanation. The kid who never heard no and had it stick. The kid who got pulled out of every uncomfortable situation before the discomfort could teach them anything. Every teacher knows this kid. Every coach, every employer who's ever hired a 22-year-old who couldn't handle being told their work needed revision. Now layer social media on top of it, a generation. And this is not every young person, so don't hear it that way. I'm young and I'm like, great. Consider yourself lucky. I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about people like this, and you know exactly who I'm talking about. So don't make this about you and start pointing the finger. Yes, that's right. Point the finger. Accountability. Shame. Other people need to start feeling it. Why are we in a situation in a world where there's so many Mackenzie Shirillas out there? Because we stopped doing that. Because we stopped holding people accountable and letting them feel their shame and sit in their shame and learn from their shame. Shame's not there just to make you feel shitty. It's there so you learn and not repeat the same maddening poor choices over and over again. But somehow we've hit it into our heads with a sledgehammer. That shame is bad and must be avoided at all costs. Shame is part of life. Shame is part of our spectrum of feelings. And you don't know the opposite until you feel the real thing. You can't feel the true highs of good choices, of good decision-making, the satisfaction that comes along with that, if you don't ever feel the opposite of it. Everything is just neutral if there's no up and down. There are so many people living in this lane, a generation, like I said, and this is not every young person, but a significant number of young people building entire identities online with zero life to back any of it up, curated images, performative confidence, a personal mythology constructed from filters and captions and follower counts, and no mechanism anywhere in the system to say, that's not real. You haven't earned that yet. You don't know what you're even talking about. The emperor has no clothes, except the emperor is 17 and has 3,000 followers and thinks the followers are the clothes. Young people have always been like this to some degree. I have, you have, we all have been young. Young and dumb. Every generation thinks it invented wisdom at 19. That's not new. What's new is parents who agree with them. What's new is an architecture that lets the mythology go unchallenged indefinitely. And what's new is that when reality finally shows up, and it always does, there's an entire support system built not to help the kid process it, but to help the kid avoid it. And if you want proof that the persona survives even a complete collision with reality, look no further than Mackenzie Shirilla in prison. A fellow inmate who served alongside her described Mackenzie as someone who showed no remorse and compared her to a character, or the character, Regina George from Mean Girls. Daily makeup, social posturing. Treating a state correctional facility like a high school cafeteria with a longer dress code. The curated identity running on autopilot in a place where it means absolutely nothing. That's not a hardened criminal learning the ropes. That's a kid who was never stress tested against anything real, dropped into the most real environment there is, and still performing the same character. The numbers back it up. Since entering the Ohio Reformatory for Women, Mackenzie has accumulated 36 conduct violations. She was found guilty in 32 of them. 7 counts of being out of place, 6 contraband filings, 4 direct order refusals, unauthorized medication, belonging to another inmate, altered prison-issued clothing, refusal to carry out a work assignment, visitation violations. And when her mother asks if she could get a job mopping or sweeping to pass the time, Mackenzie says they won't let people with her charges get jobs. Then admit she hasn't actually asked anyone about it. This isn't someone struggling to adapt to consequences for the first time and finding it hard. This is someone who has never adapted to consequences and sees no reason to start. The prison is just the latest environment that's supposed to bend around her. And when it doesn't, when it refuses to deliver her iPad or let her skip work details or give her special treatment, she calls her mother and complains that she's bored. She doesn't eat the prison food. She wants to know why the day is going so slowly. She has one book and she's not planning to read the same book over and over again. She's 3 years into a life sentence for killing 2 people and her emotional register is indistinguishable from a teenager whose flight got delayed. But she doesn't build herself. And this is where it gets uncomfortable for anyone listening who's a parent. Go back to Steve. He went on a national documentary defending his convicted daughter and casually endorsing her drug use on camera. He lost his teaching position at a Catholic school for it. And instead of recognizing that maybe going on Netflix and saying you're fine with your teenager's drug use while your daughter sits in prison for killing 2 people was a miscalculation. His takeaway was that the school betrayed him. His focus, in his own words, is the injustice my daughter has been put through. His only focus. Let's go back to Natalie. She's on the recorded prison line, and her daughter, convicted by a judge, sentenced to life, upheld on appeal, tells her she doesn't need rehab. And Natalie says, that's right. Rehabilitation is for real criminals, not you. That's not support. That's construction. That's the mother actively building the walls of an alternative reality her daughter lives in. Brick by brick, on a recorded line while her daughter sits in prison for driving through an actual brick wall at 100 miles an hour. The Shirillas didn't just fail to prepare their daughter for reality. They constructed an alternative one and moved the whole family into it. And they're still doing it. Steve blames the school. Natalie blames the Russo family. Mackenzie blames boredom. Nobody in this family at any point in this entire process has said the words, "This happened and it was wrong and we have to face it." That's the machine. That's the factory. And it's not unique to the Shirillas. Christine Russo, Dominic's sister, said it in an interview. They created a monster. They're the monsters themselves. That's earned rage from a woman who lost her brother. And she's not wrong about the result. But Steve and Natalie probably don't look like monsters to themselves. They look like loyal parents. They look like the only people who didn't abandon their daughter when the whole world turned on her. And that framing, that specific, common, terrifyingly recognizable framing, is what sits at the center of every one of these stories. They confuse protecting their daughter with protecting her from reality. And those are two completely different things. Protecting your kid means teaching them that actions have consequences, that the world doesn't recognize itself around their feelings, that being uncomfortable is not the same as being attacked. Protecting your kid from reality means intercepting every consequence, rewriting every failure, and making sure they never have to sit with the weight of what they've done. One of those builds a person who can survive contact with the world. The other builds a person who drives 100 miles an hour into a wall and then asks for her iPad. Mackenzie Shirilla isn't bored in prison because she's a different species. She's not collecting conduct violation because she's uniquely broken. She's bored, and she's defiant, and she's performing a character nobody's watching because nobody, not her parents, not her social circle, not any structure in her life, ever let her be uncomfortable long enough to learn that discomfort is information, that discomfort is where you figure out who you actually are instead of who you've been performing. She had 17 years to learn that, 17 years of chances for someone to say, "No, Mackenzie, that's not how this works. You don't get to skip the part where things are hard." And nobody said it. Or they did. And if they did, Steve and Natalie made sure it didn't stick. The distance between "I'm supporting my child" and "I'm building a person who can't survive contact with reality" is shorter than any parent wants to admit. And Mackenzie Shirilla, sitting in the Ohio Reformatory for Women, complaining about her one book and her missing iPad and the slowness of a Tuesday afternoon, is what looks like when you get to the end of that distance and discover there's a wall. She still says she doesn't need to be rehabilitated. And the two people who could have told her otherwise are still agreeing with her. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Love for you to weigh in. We'll continue the conversation right there. Links are in the description. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're listening to us. Apple Podcasts, take us with you wherever you go. YouTube, Spotify, whatever it is, hit subscribe. We do greatly appreciate that. Until next time, my name's Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Normally in these ads, you'd expect someone like me to ask you to buy something, but I want to ask you to do something different. I'm Dave Farenthold, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm an investigative reporter, which means that I follow the money, inside of government and outside of government. The point of my job is to find things people are trying to hide. It involves talking to lots of people. It involves looking through lots and lots of documents. And if there weren't folks like me to go beyond the surface to understand who is really shaping what the government does, the public would be left in the dark about what the government's doing with your tax money, what the government's doing to you through regulations and spending. If you're like me and you think this kind of journalism is important, seek out a news source that does firsthand, fact-based reporting. If that's the New York Times, thank you. If that's your local paper, that's great too, because where you get your information matters.